We all know that owning a small business means you wear many hats, but sometimes you really need an extra pair of hands. Upwork is how good companies find great and trusted freelance talent. With more than 2 decades of experience, with the simple and ambitious goal of pioneering a better way of working, companies at every stage turn to Upwork to get things done and find more flexibility in staffing key projects and initiatives. They access a global marketplace filled with top talent in IT, web dev, marketing, and more. Posting a job on Upwork is easy. With no cost to join, you can register, browse freelancer profiles, and get help drafting a job post or even book a consultation. From there, you connect with freelancers that get you and can easily hire them and take your business to the next level. Visit Upwork.com right now and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to post your job for free and connect with top talent ready to help your business grow. That's UPWORK.com, Upwork.com.
Hey everyone, this is Colin. And I have another huge case update to all the case updates you'll hear on this special relaunch episode of Undisclosed. Simply put, this one is absolutely enormous. Back in 2019, we covered the case of Rocky Myers. Rocky was convicted of capital murder in connection with the death of his neighbor, Ludie Mae Tucker, in Alabama. Now, at the time we took on Rocky's case, he was in a really bad spot. His prior attorney had failed to meet an appellate deadline. What this meant was, simply put, Rocky was out of options in the courts. That left one final Hail Mary to avoid Rocky being executed: Alabama's governor commuting his death sentence to a life sentence. Now, based on the reporting, there were good reasons for her to do so. Despite Ludie Mae Tucker being alive for a period of time after she was stabbed, she did not name Rocky as her assailant. She did not simply point across the street, despite Rocky being her neighbor and her knowing him quite well. On the other hand, Ludie Mae said the person who stabbed her was wearing a white t-shirt with bloodstains. On the other hand, various witnesses said that the night of the murder, Rocky was wearing a dark shirt and a dark jacket. This might help to explain why multiple jurors have come forward after conviction saying, "We actually thought Rocky was innocent. We changed our vote to guilty to recommend a life sentence to the judge, who then overrode us and imposed a death sentence." But beyond this, we found one huge piece of evidence pointing towards the innocence of Rocky Myers in this case, a study called Good Shedder or Bad Shedder. According to that study, someone with the untreated skin condition eczema is 90% likely to leave behind a full DNA profile at a crime scene. But despite Rocky having untreated eczema at the time of the murder, no skin cells, no hair, no fingerprints, no DNA, nothing ties Rocky Myers to the crime scene, strongly pointing towards his innocence in this case. But despite all this evidence, a couple weeks ago, the Supreme Court of Alabama cleared the way for Rocky to be executed. But then, on Friday, February 28th, the Hail Mary landed. Beyond all hope, beyond all expectation, Governor Kay Ivey commuted Rocky's death sentence to a life sentence. But beyond that, she pointed to many of the same pieces of evidence of Rocky's innocence that we reported on in the podcast. According to Governor Ivey, in the case of Ludie Mae Tucker's murder, I have enough questions about Mr. Myers' guilt that I cannot move forward with executing him. For example, no murder weapon was found, and no DNA evidence or fingerprints or other physical evidence tied Mr. Myers to the scene of the crime. Although Ms. Tucker knew Mr. Myers and led her attacker inside the house, neither she nor Marie Dutton, the only two eyewitnesses to the crime, ever identified Mr. Myers as the assailant. There is also other circumstantial evidence, but it is riddled with conflicting evidence from seemingly everyone involved. This is the first commutation of a death sentence to a life sentence in Alabama since 1999. Now, Rocky's current attorney, Casey Keaton, added, "I have represented Mr. Myers since 2007. As evidence accumulated of his innocence and the many injustices he experienced over the course of his case, I held out hope that he would someday see a measure of justice, of mercy, of humanity." Now, it's still unclear whether Rocky can prove his innocence and be released, but at least now he'll be doing that while off of death row. With Undisclosed now back, we'll keep updating you on the status of Rocky's case and all the other cases we covered in Undisclosed. Thank you.
Hi, and welcome back to Undisclosed. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author, and I am joined by my co-host, Colin Miller. Hi, Colin.
Hey, how are you doing? This is Colin Miller. I am a professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
Man, it is good to see you, Colin, after quite a minute. And we have been meaning to relaunch Undisclosed, and we're finally here.
Yeah, it's taken us some time to think things through, build up some cases, but now we're both in a good position to start things back up again.
Yeah, and you know, it's been, by the time we relaunch, and we're planning on relaunching with a brand new season in late spring of this year, it will have been, is it 2 or 3 years? Now I'm losing track of time since we...
I think we stopped maybe February 2022, so now we're February 2025.
You are an encyclopedia, so I know you're right. I know you're right on that. A lot has happened since then in both of our lives, too, not just in the workspace. But yes, I finally feel like the space has reopened. And this work to both of us and Susan, by the way, Susan's gone on to make Proof, which is a fantastic wrongful conviction podcast that has had impact and helped actually release innocent defendants. We have continued to do the innocence work in the background because it's kind of like the heart of our what we love to do now. But what we wanted to do today, and you know, we wanted to put this episode out just to kind of give you guys updates on cases you've heard on Undisclosed, things we've been working on, and let you know what the new season's going to be, and just get everybody, like, you know, teed up and ready for the relaunch. So let's start off with updates on some of our Undisclosed cases. Colin, why don't you lead off on that?
Yeah, so we had a partial update on this one already, and now we have a further update, which is a first for Undisclosed. And so this was the case of Dennis Perry, and you might recall he was convicted. Yeah. 1985 murders of Harold and Thelma Swain at the Rising Daughter Baptist Church in Waverly, Georgia. And this was the crazy case where there was this pair of glasses that was found at the church that didn't belong to anyone at the church.
Right.
Unsolved Mysteries looked at the case. The glasses went missing, but we still had the hairs that were taken from the glasses. And so when we were presenting Dennis's case, we, among other things, talked about alternate suspects, one of those being Eric Spahr. Mm-hmm. And so I'm reading our transcript from the episode of what we said. If there had been a checklist of the known attributes of the killing at Rising Daughter, the description of Eric Spahr would seem to tick off just about every box. The Frankenstein 3-in-1 glasses, the boots, the missing overshirt that would have been torn off in the shooting, the white t-shirt underneath that some of the witnesses had seen, plus Eric Spahr was a welder and a mechanic, the two professions that were suggested by slag marks on the glasses found at the church.
Oh, wow. Wow, man, yeah. We really clocked it.
We said Spahr had shoulder-length brownish hair, which was not far off from the witnesses described, and so... Our initial update we had was they had reached out to Gladys Spahr, his mother, asked for a sample of her hair.
Right.
Tested the mitochondrial DNA, which is passed from mother to child. And
she turned over a hairbrush or something, right?
Like, yeah, a hairbrush. Like, yeah. And the hair testing determines, yes, it had the same mitochondrial DNA profile as the hairs found from the glasses at the crime scene. And so we left off the podcast, the update being... Dennis Perry is exonerated. He's set free. All of a sudden now, December 2024, Georgia Bureau of Investigation says, we have officially arrested Eric Spahr for the murder of Harold and Thelma Swain. He has been charged with murders. No updates since then. They say it's an ongoing investigation, but every reason to believe we have now the right person arrested for those murders, and a trial might be coming in the future to bring him to justice.
Oh, man, that's incredible. This might be the only case. I mean, we've had, like, you know, great success in helping with exonerations or reduction of sentences or whatever. But is this the only case from Undisclosed where there's been an arrest in an alternate suspect?
Yeah, this is the first, as far as I can recall, where beyond the person we talked about being exonerated, we now have, yes, an alternate suspect officially arrested and charged with the crime at issue.
We caught the killer. They caught the killer. So this arrest was based on the DNA match, the hair and the glasses, and that's pretty much it, right? Or do we know if there's anything else that they've got them on?
The GBI in their announcement said, this is an open case. We're not revealing the detail. If you have information, come forward and let us know. So there might be more stuff going on behind the scenes, but that's all we officially know, is that the hair was a match for the mother of Eric Spahr.
Well, I look forward to that trial and seeing, you know, how do you feel about, if that was the only evidence, do you think that's strong enough to get the conviction anyways?
I mean, the profession match with the slag marks and the glasses, the hair recovered, mitochondrial DNA is about as good as it gets in terms of forensic evidence. So I think that that would be pretty strong. There was some mention, we talked about it in the podcast and in the reporting, about him claiming he had an alibi. And so that needs to be investigated some more, I think, to see if that alibi can be ruled out. This was, again, the cold case where it took years to solve it. So there might be some questions in terms of evidence of innocence. We don't want to jump to any conclusions that happens in our cases, but the evidence to me seems pretty strong at this point.
Yeah, well, congratulations to the GBI and to Georgia Innocence and to Dennis Perry and to Susan, who is the lead investigator, and everybody else who, and why not to us too? Yay for us. we did a good job with that case. All right, my first update is about the Jason Carroll case. And the Jason Carroll case, I believe, was the final season of Undisclosed before we went on hiatus. It was a case that came to us from the New England Innocence Project. And it was kind of like the first, according to them, like real examination of a wrongful conviction or innocence case coming out of New Hampshire, period. And the crime involved was the murder of Sharon Johnson, who was 37 years old. In July of 1988, she had been stabbed 14 times and strangled. She was like 8 months pregnant. Her body was found in this construction site. And she had a kind of a loose connection to a young man named Jason Carroll, who was a 19-year-old high school dropout at the time. He was arrested 18 months after the murder, after intense police interrogation that also involved his mother, who was a police officer in the same jurisdiction, being brought into the interrogation and really leaning into him. And we, during the podcast, aired a lot of the interrogation, and it was awful. It was pretty bad. And you could hear him weeping, Jason's weeping, that mom, like, I didn't do this. But he finally broke down and confessed. And based on his confessions, he was convicted. Really, there was no other evidence in this case. In 1992, he was found guilty, second-degree murder. He was sentenced to 46 years to life in prison. But, you know, immediately after his confession, he's like, I didn't do it. He recanted immediately and maintained his innocence ever since. Now, we covered the case in our final season of Undisclosed. And after we did so, Bear Brook, that's hosted by Jason Moon. Bear Brook is a really, you know, incredible, well-regarded true crime podcast, has award-winning podcast, in fact. And they made it their season two case. And Jason Moon, who is a local in New Hampshire, and actually he tagged along during our investigation because I wanted to get local coverage while we were doing this. He's continued to work with the New England Innocence Project. And through their continued work after Bear Brook came out, they found a number of boxes of evidence that we did not know existed. And it's just one of those situations where when you ask the state, is there any evidence like that we can be like DNA tested? They're like, nope. I mean, that we've heard that so many times in different cases. And then these boxes are discovered in a warehouse somewhere just through manual searching because a county clerk was like, fine, you can go take a look.
Yeah, well, it was the basement, right?
Yeah, it was in the basement of the courthouse. And so some of that evidence includes the victim's fingernail clippings, a white long sleeve shirt that was stained and it was found near the crime scene, and several knives. So it was a brutal killing. And there's every reason to suspect that Sharon may have tried to defend herself, right? And that the killer's DNA might show up on her fingernails.
Right.
After this evidence was discovered, the assistant attorney general really fought against DNA testing for 18 months, even saying in a motion that there's no scenario where testing these items will exonerate the defendant. Now, if you recall, we step-by-step kind of showed why it seemed like the strongest suspect for this was Ken Johnson, her husband, who has since passed away. There were lots of reasons that Ken should have been looked at more closely. He was really never properly ruled out as a suspect. And you know, if it's Ken's DNA under her fingernail clippings, by the way, let me get back to what I was saying. But anyhow, about a year ago, he reversed his opinion, the attorney general, and said, you know what? Fine, we will move forward and do DNA testing on this. And so right now, like I think they've developed a DNA testing plan, but the results of the DNA testing has not come back. And so I did think it was interesting, though, because in a situation like this, where it could be intimate partner violence that has led to this killing, if you do find DNA of that suspect on the victim, I mean, there is an argument to be made. Well, yeah, that was her husband. Of course, his DNA is going to be all over her. So, Jason, has not been exonerated. He's still serving his sentence. He's 53 years old, maintains his innocence. But to what extent do you think it could be exculpatory, Colin, if they come back and there's Ken's DNA under her fingernails?
Right, to your point, DNA, period, on the husband wouldn't be suspicious. DNA under the fingernails, including blood under the fingernails, given the nature of the crime and what we know of the crime scene, I think would be pretty incriminatory against the husband and pretty exculpatory in terms of Jason.
What do you think about the shift? Do you the shift from the Attorney General's office? Do you think that's a sign that, because look, and we've seen this too in other cases, if the DNA comes back and it's not Jason's and it's Ken's, right? Like they get a definitive match. We've seen prosecutors say, yeah, well, you know what? Maybe both of them were involved. It doesn't exclude, it's as far as we're concerned, it doesn't mean it's exculpatory. We have seen this over and over again. But considering now that they're like, no, we will join this petition for DNA and we're not fighting it anymore, do you think that's a shift in a sense that they might be open to the idea he's innocent?
Absolutely, because I see in innocence cases, I've researched the two tracks, which is one, the AG, the prosecution fights tooth and nail. We don't want DNA testing. The judge grants it. It produces results that are helpful to the defendant, and the AG prosecution dig in their heels and say, no, it's not exculpatory. Here, as you know, for the AG to initially say we oppose it before relenting and saying, now we're going to allow it. Not 100%, but I think you're onto something of that shows some willingness to accept that if this DNA does come back a certain way, they would find that sufficiently exculpatory to release Jason, as you said, and release him and make sure that he is the first New Hampshire exoneree in history.
According to AAG Charles Buca, in their reversal, he said they arrived at their new position upon a review of the evidentiary items and reports of the expert witnesses, which almost makes me think that the initial objection was like kind of a knee-jerk reaction. Like it's kind of like what the state has to do, which is weird. It's like you could take your time and come to a decision before you do that. But I'm glad they did. And this is heartening because it's rare. It is rare to see this. So and yeah. So we are waiting and we'll continue to follow and see what happens in the Jason Carroll case. Once we have DNA results back, we will definitely update you guys.
Absolutely. And so Jason Carroll was our final long season. That takes me then to our penultimate long season, which was the Jeff Titus case. And so Jeff Titus, as you might recall, he lived in Michigan. And in 1990, at the opening of hunting season, we have two men, James Bennett, Doug Estes. They are found dead in the Fulton State gaming area that adjoins Jeff's backyard. The theory of the case by the state is Jeff doesn't like people hunting and kind of trespassing on his property. And so they believe that he killed both of these men in the area adjoining his backyard. Jeff had a really strong alibi. He had witnesses showing he was about 27 miles away on the afternoon of the murders, hunting somewhere else. Despite that, the prosecution convinces the jury maybe he slipped away, drove home, shot these hunters, and came back. And so obviously, we mentioned Eric Spahr before as an alternate suspect. A big focus in our Jeff Titus coverage was we went through the files and found they didn't have evidence concerning this alternate suspect, a serial killer named Thomas Dillon. And Thomas Dillon was going around the Midwest and killing hunters, including in the days before and after the murders in this case. And so that led to the development with the Michigan Innocence Project of this Brady claim, Brady again being state failing to disclose
Our
material.
listeners know, Colin. They are well versed in Brady. But yeah, go ahead and remind
And
them.
so, right beyond that, this was, if you recall, shortly after the double homicide, we have witnesses who see a man who had driven his car into a ditch. That led to a composite sketch. As we posted on our website, this composite sketch looked a lot like Thomas Dillon. This was really strong evidence that this alternate suspect, Thomas Dillon, was the killer and not Jeff Titus. And so,
And wait a
that,
minute, remind me of two things, if you remember. Did Jeff Titus have any connection with the victims at all?
No
Was there any?
connection.
There's no connection. Okay, so
Nothing with them.
it would just be a weird random killing, according to the state. He just randomly ran back and killed some guys he didn't know and then left.
Correct.
Number one. Okay, and the second thing I was going to ask was the Brady material was that the state had this information on the serial killer and didn't turn it over to the defense at the time. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay.
They knew he could be someone who committed this murder.
Okay.
They knew about the composite sketch. They had all this in their files, and they did not turn this over to the defense at the time of trial.
Okay. Okay.
And so, yeah, about a year after we wrapped in February 2023, his petition for writ of habeas corpus based upon the Brady violation was granted. A few months later in June, we have the prosecutor saying, I can't take this case back to trial. The conviction was lacking in integrity, all the issues that arose in this case, partially from our coverage. And so in June, he dismisses the charges against Jeff. Jeff seeks compensation through the state system in Michigan. He is awarded $1 million in damages. And now he has currently brought a lawsuit against the people suppressing the evidence. And Saravia, I don't know if you've seen the coverage. Guess how much he is seeking in damages for the Brady violation here?
I have no idea. I have no idea.
$100 million.
I
So
was gonna say 1 million doesn't cut it.
you anchor it high. You're shooting for that anchoring effect. And so, yeah,
Yeah.
seeking $100 million in
So
damages.
he's suing them in their personal capacity or their official capacity? Aren't they like protected under their official capacity?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fuzzy area in terms of Brady violations and whether you can get civil liability against them. Likely it's angling towards a settlement, but yeah, I mean, you anchor
Yeah.
it high and you see what you can get. And obviously he has a strong case here of, and this, again, this is another cold case situation where a new team came in and this evidence was suppressed. And yeah, I mean, it's, you know,
Is this
all the power to
unusual? I
you.
mean, because I'm trying to think of my brain is pretty fried though at this point. I'm trying to think of other cases in which anybody has successfully brought a civil lawsuit for a Brady violation. I feel like Brady violations are just so, I mean, like there's no accountability when state actors commit Brady.
Yeah, Willie Vesey, one of our prior cases,
Okay.
reached a settlement, and that was a Brady violation. That was, if I'm looking at the number, $5 million. So he brought an action
Oh.
against the city of Philadelphia. You might recall, he
Oh,
was
yes, I do remember. Okay.
convicted based upon an eyewitness who is legally blind. He had an alibi that he was at his dishwashing job at the time of the murder.
Yep.
And these were the shady, I think it was called the Goon Squad
Yeah.
in Philadelphia, who they were in a series of wrongful convictions based upon abusive tactics in interrogating and investigating cases. And so, yeah, he got $5 million from Philadelphia.
Okay.
I wouldn't be surprised to see Jeff Titus get a similar number.
Wonderful. Well, we wish him well and all the many millions he deserves. All right. My next update is the Greg Lance case. So to refresh your memories, Greg Lance was arrested in April of 1999 for the double homicides of Victor and Alla Kolesnikow, who they were a Ukrainian couple that lived in Cookeville, Tennessee. And at the time of the murder, Greg was 26. He managed this, he had purchased this mobile home park from the Kolesnikows, and they were kind of like landowners. They leased a lot of land and rented it and sold it and did all kinds of shady things, but they were not well liked locally. They had like 26 pending lawsuits with locals at the time of their murders for trying to evict people and just all kinds of stuff. Like, so they weren't loved. Now, he was not arrested until a year after the murder, and the husband and wife, Victor and Alla Kolesnikow, were found. Their property was completely burned to the ground, and when the autopsies were conducted, it was determined they had been shot and killed before the house had been set on fire. So, when this case came to us, to me, and Greg's mother had reached out to me, and we met up. He was not represented at the time, and in fact, had attempted to get representation from the Innocence Project. They weren't interested. We managed to get them interested, and they along with Bass, oh gosh, what's it, Bassberry Sims, it's a huge firm in Tennessee, took on the case pro bono. And anyhow, we covered the case, and after we covered the case, Hillary Burton Morgan, who is an actor well known, she is the host of a show on Sundance called It Can't Happen Here, which features in one episode one case per episode, basically small town crimes and murders. And they came across our season of Undisclosed and they decided to feature the case. And here's what happened next. The episode ran. I was interviewed on it briefly, and the episode aired. And a woman who was watching that Sundance episode of It Can't Happen Here was like, "Oh gosh, they're bringing up a name that sounds really familiar." And that name was Sam Horn. Sam Horn was the person that we identified as the most likely suspect. In fact, I was like, "Sam definitely did it," but you can't say that. Anyhow, all roads led to Sam and his wife, Peggy Horn, and they were also people who had property issues with the Klusnikows. They lived across the street from Klusnikows. There was lots of different reasons to suspect them. Anyhow, this woman watching the show says, "I know that name. I know the name Sam Horn. Oh, I think that's my boyfriend's father." Calls her boyfriend. His name is Mitchell, except he goes by Tim. Calls Tim and says, "This show is on TV, and I feel like they're talking about your dad, Sam Horn." He watches the show and he's like, "Oh my God, not only are they talking about my dad, but my dad did this." Because he, according to him, on the day of the murders, he arrived to his father's house. Now, we knew that Sam and Peggy had a daughter. I did not uncover that he had the son from a previous marriage. And that was an investigative oversight, certainly on my part, and even on the part of the attorneys working on this all these years, we just did not know. He remembered the day of the murders, going to his father's house. He was an adult at the time. And when he got there, the Klusnikow property across the street was still smoldering. There was still smoke coming off. It was that fresh. So he comes and he's like, his father confessed to him then. "Yeah, we did that. I took care of them." And because they were going to get evicted from their property. He had no idea decades later that somebody else had gone down for the crime. He knew because his father had confessed to him more than one time. And it wasn't a confession. It was just like, "Yeah, we did it. I had to take care of it." His father had told him more than once that him and Peggy had murdered the Klusnikows. But he never knew that someone else had been wrongfully convicted. And he was mortified by this. So he reached out to Greg's attorneys, reached out to the Innocence Project, and he offered an affidavit, attesting to this very thing that my father—I have personal knowledge that my father, committed these crimes because he told me this stuff. Anyhow, that was a big breakthrough, obviously. And in the interim, the Innocence Project was and the pro bono attorneys were able to uncover a couple of other witnesses as well, and enough to basically compel a DNA motion. Now, Colin, you are our legal professor, and I learned from you that every state in the country has DNA statutes. But what is kind of the standard for a defendant to get evidence t DNA tested in their case?
Yeah, so as you say, it really does vary from state to state, but the most common test is this testing likely to produce evidence that, if it ends up a certain way, could be exculpatory towards the defendant, right? And so, would we expect the defendant's DNA to be on this item? And then, therefore, is the absence of his or her DNA evidence of innocence in this case?
Right. It's not just enough to be like, "There's the physical evidence. Can I just DNA test it?" You almost have to make a proffer of innocence and show some kind of other supporting evidence, right, to convince a judge to go forward with the DNA testing. Well, in November of 2022, DNA testing was finally conducted in this case on the murder weapon. Okay. And this was a gun that had been found about a mile away from the crime scene. And the ballistic testing, which we all know can be hairy, but it was determined that this was the gun used to kill the Klusnikows. They did the DNA testing, and it came back with mixed DNA from at least one male. What's it called? Not prov What is it called when a DNA? Sorry, to edit this out. But anyhow, from one male, and then other mixed DNA from other people, but excluding Greg Lance. Okay, so that's what the DNA testing showed. So this a year ago, in July of 2024, there was a hearing on the post-conviction petition that Greg's team had filed, requesting a new trial. Okay, I went to the hearing. Hillary Burton was also there. She has been a great supporter of exonerating Greg this whole time. And the hearing lasted, was it 2 days or I can't remember now. But it seemed to go really, really well. And Tim Horn, Sam's son, testified. He testified that his father first confessed the crime as the smoke was coming up off the victim's house. And he said that later, numerous times, he brought this up and said that he had done it. Now, I want to remind folks, Tim Horn does not know Greg Lance at all. In fact, the Horns did not know. There was no connection between Greg Lance and anybody in the Horn atmosphere, basically, in their circle. Somebody else who testified was somebody who had was a cellmate of Sam Horn's nephew, Mike Horn. And we talked about Mike Horn. Now, remember, there was a whole episode in our season called Murder Clan, and there's a reason the Horns were called the Murder Clans locally. Mike Horn was one of those murderers. And this cellmate was, his name is, what was the name? Derek Helms, excuse me. Derek Helms was cellmate of Mike Horn, and he said that Mike had told him that he is the one who dumped the murder weapon a couple of, you know, away from the murder scene because his uncle asked him to. We had that. There was also, you know, another witness that said that, another witness also said that Sam had confessed in front of him. Anyhow, there was a number of witnesses who said that we have knowledge one way or the other that the Horns were behind this crime. And then the DNA experts, there were two DNA experts who testified, and they said that none of the evidence, DNA evidence, matched Greg's DNA. He is definitely excluded. And the hearing went great, we thought. The judge seemed very fair. He complimented the DNA experts. Like, you know, I thought it went great. We felt good. And then the judge said, I'm going to rule in 90 days. Well, the judge did rule, but in November, and he denied the motion for a new trial. This is what he said, basically. He said that he found none of the witnesses credible, none of them. And he said the fact that the DNA, none of Greg's DNA showed up on the murder weapon doesn't mean he didn't do it, which is the kind of which is the argument the state also made, that it did not prove that he's innocent. And so in its conclusion, the court said the petitioner has not established actual innocence by clear and convincing evidence, and he is not entitled to a new trial. So Greg is now 51. He has been in prison for about 26 years. And, you know, it was a really shocking ruling and devastating for everybody. I mean, I can't even tell you Greg's family like has gone through, but that's the thing. It's like when you sit through these things, you never know how a jury's gonna, you know, decide on a verdict. You never know which way a judge is gonna do, because you feel one thing and you're like, none of it's real. It was really shocking. And what do you think about how the judge ruled on this, given what was presented, which I thought was overwhelming evidence?
Yeah, I mean, you start with the credibility aspect, right? And to your point, there's no obvious reason for deceit or lies. So it's not based upon an objective analysis, the evidence, for the judge to say, oh, this person's a friend of the defendant trying to exonerate him, etc. So it's solely the judge in the courtroom subjectively assessing what he feels the credibility of the witnesses are. Obviously, people who were there, including yourself, think they came off as credible. That's a subjective take. In terms of the DNA, I don't get that at all, because I just stated the standard before. And to your point, this is the murder weapon. The fact that his DNA is not on it and there's a mixture of other people and we can exclude him as the source, to me, that feels exculpatory enough to meet the clear and convincing evidence standard.
I don't remember. I know there was a process to get to some agreement about what would be tested. And I believe there were casings collected from the crime scene. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they were preserved. I don't know if they're available for DNA testing, or if they could even really be tested, considering they, you know, the whole place was set on fire after the murders, right? Like, that might have destroyed DNA evidence. But the other thing is, you know, they also didn't conclusively tie the DNA they found to anybody.
Right.
And Sam
would be stronger.
Would
necessary, but stronger.
I mean, I'm like, I feel like this judge, I mean, if Sam Horn's DNA showed up, and this is where I'm like, oh, it's like, can we just take that one extra step? Sam Horn's DNA is not in CODIS. And that is something we talked about during our season, because we're like, this guy committed crime after crime after crime and got away with it over. And we're like, you know, was he an informant? Was he, I believe he was working with law enforcement. There's a reason he, you know, he was a local meth, you know, dealer and he cooked it in his, you know, and law enforcement knew. Like how was he protected constantly? In fact, shortly after the murders, somebody who was very close to Sam Horn's circle went to the lead investigator and said, this was Sam Horn. He did it. And the lead investigator's like, stop talking right now. I don't want to talk about this. He already had his sights on Greg. So, you know, his DNA doesn't show up anywhere. I don't even know if his fingerprints might show up anywhere, really, because I don't know if he was ever booked for anything. But here's the thing. We still have genetic genealogy now, right?
Yes. Yes.
So why can't we do that? Why can't we do the genetic genealogy? So I have to. So this ruling came down in November. This is right before I left for Pakistan for the 85th event of my daughter's wedding. It was the longest wedding ever last year. But I have just reached out to the family recently and said, look, what's next, man? What's next? Because number one, let's do genetic genealogy testing. If the state, if there's no fight, if you have your hands on the profile. But also, I really think like in cases like this, maybe a political fix is it. Maybe what we need to do is help Putnam County get a new DA and show up for the elections and just get the extra 500 votes it's going to take to swing this. So because I feel like the right person in charge will make the right decisions. And so far, it's been a very uphill battle for Greg getting testing done, getting anything done. But anyhow, it was an awful decision. It was shocking to me. And it's really depressing.
Yeah, I mean, that's always the roughest part is when you feel like you've uncovered the evidence that's going to set someone free, a hearing goes well, and then the ruling goes the other way.
Yeah.
It's devastating.
Yeah. All right. Do you have another update for us, Colin?
Yeah. Next update is the case of Darrell Ewing. This was one of our very last miniseries that we had. And so Darrell Ewing was convicted of the murder of J.B. Watson in Detroit in 2009. This was despite several witnesses placing him at a repast at the time of the murder. A repast is in the African-American community, some other communities, sort of a ceremony after a funeral. And several witnesses say, not only was he there, we were doing a slideshow for the repast and we had issues with technology. He's really tech savvy. He was helping with the mechanics of the slideshow, essentially around the same time the murder is taking place. And so he's convicted. Later, his conviction was reversed based upon jury misconduct with jurors looking things up online they weren't supposed to. Beyond that, the strong evidence of innocence was another individual, Tyree Washington, confessed to the murder. And there were issues about the state not disclosing that. We played some of his recorded confession on Undisclosed. It lines up with the crime scene evidence. It's a perfect fit. And so ultimately, based upon lack of disclosures regarding Washington's confession, other issues. In March 2024, the judge officially dismissed the charges against Darrell. The state's trying to appeal, but it looks pretty good at this point that he's not going to be re-prosecuted for this murder. Mm-hmm. And then, Ravia, the update here is Darrell, for many years, worked on his case. He's a smart guy. He now, this fall, 2024, enrolled in law school. And so his goal, after all of his own work on his case, is to become a lawyer. He is currently enrolled in Detroit in law school with the goal of himself becoming a lawyer now.
That is fantastic. That is so wonderful. I mean,
absolutely.
Okay. That's good news. Gosh, it feels good when, you know, when it all works out. Yeah. All right. So Colin,
one more update. Do you have another
update? You do. No, yeah. I'm done with my updates, okay. But yeah.
One last update. This is the very last case we covered on Undisclosed, a miniseries, the case of Wayne Brady and Carl Willis. And so the two of them were convicted of the 1998 murder of 13-year-old Maurice Purify in Toledo, Ohio. Only evidence against them essentially is this man, Travis Slaughter, who told the police, I was at the crime scene when Brady and Willis committed this murder. Travis Slaughter is essentially a Jay Wilds. His story to police was so contradictory, so coached, et cetera. Yeah. When this case went to the grand jury, 99% of cases that go to a grand jury lead to an indictment, meaning there's probable cause. The case goes to trial. The grand jury did not believe a word that Travis Slaughter said. They refused to indict Wayne Brady and Carl Willis. Thereafter, Travis's girlfriend, Chandrea Rayford, comes forward and says, Travis told me that Willis and Brady committed the murder before he was questioned by police, meaning they couldn't have fed him the information.
Okay.
State takes the case to a second grand jury. They indict. Case goes to trial. Chandrea Rayford starts testifying. She clams up. Jurors
on the stand,
clams up on the stand, is held in contempt of court. The jurors convict. Jurors interviewed after the fact say, we thought she was afraid of Wayne Brady and Carl Willis. That's why she clammed up.
Did Slaughter also testify at that trial?
He does. He testifies.
He does. Okay. Okay.
And so Chandrea says, I didn't clam up because I was afraid of Wayne Brady and Carl Willis. Travis Slaughter told me to go to the police and say, he told them, or he told me, that Brady and Willis committed this murder before they questioned him. And so that was the real reason why this happened. And so ultimately, Travis Slaughter himself says, this was a false confession. I was pressured by the police. I have no information about who killed Maurice Purify. And so at the time,
What was his incentive to do that? Was he protecting himself? What was going on?
He was protecting himself, right? Okay. He was brought in. He was believed to be involved in the murder. He might have been involved in the murder. We're not sure. And so he doesn't bring up Brady and Willis. It's brought up by the police. And essentially, it's pretty clear how he eventually implicates them in the crime. And so after our season of Undisclosed, to close it out, they're appealing their conviction, claiming, look, the only witness against us has recanted. And so, Robbie, I guess what the state does as this appeal is pending, what do they offer to Wayne Brady and Carl Willis?
I don't know. Could it be an Alford plea, maybe?
An Alford plea, right? So if you go ahead and stop your appeal, we will give you an Alford plea to time served. This was in March 2023. And we've discussed this several times. Even though they had a pretty strong claim, I think, based upon Travis Slaughter recanting and claiming he falsely confessed, they accepted the Alford pleas. They are now both free men. Alford plea, again, is you are factually maintaining, I'm innocent, I didn't commit this crime, but I'm allowing this conviction to stand. And so bittersweet, sort of a mixed result, but they're free. They accepted the Alford plea, time served. They are now both free men.
It does prevent them to get any kind of compensation, right?
Correct. Exactly.
But also, but at the same time, and I don't remember this, but I believe at the same time, they can continue to find ways to exonerate, right? They can continue to try to exonerate themselves.
Yes. Yep. After taking the Alford plea, there are still mechanisms available to try to have a certificate of innocence after the fact.
Wow. How long did they serve in prison?
They served, I mean, 20 plus years. The murder was in 1998, so I think they were convicted maybe 99, 2000. So yeah, I mean, 22 years. Yeah.
Is there any update on the Temujin Kensu case?
Temujin Kensu has gotten a lot of additional press coverage since our podcast. A lot of different.
I am haunted by that one. I just can't get over. I mean,
they're seeking clemency from Governor Whitmer there in Michigan. The CIU did not come through. And so, that's a case where there's a lot of support for him. But he's still fighting to prove his innocence.
I'll just never get over the state's theory in that case, which is that this absolutely broke man took a private plane to go kill somebody in a parking lot and then went back. I mean, how could the CIU be like, yeah, that sounds right to us. Okay. All right. So in the interim, since in our last few years of hiatus, I mentioned to folks that we've still been working on different things. What have you been working on?
Yeah, well, I mean, I have a few things I've been working on. The first I can mention, cause this just had a resolution last week. This was another, Hillary Burton Morgan case from Can't Happen Here. The very first case they handled was the Caitlin Conley case. And so I saw the episode, I tweeted about it, and Caitlin's sister reached out to me. Basically, this is a fairly salacious case where Caitlin Conley was a receptionist at a chiropractor's office. The chiropractor was Dr. Mary Yoder. Caitlin's ex-boyfriend was Adam Yoder. And this is in 2015. On July 20th, and Dr. Yoder at some point during the day has severe symptoms that lead to her hospitalization and her death. And it's later determined that she died from ingestion of colchicine, which is a medication that is used to treat gout, other inflammatory diseases. When taken at higher doses, it's fatal. And so, Rabia, here is the state's theory of the case. Caitlin poisoned her boss's lunch with colchicine on July 20th, thinking that if her ex-boyfriend, Adam, his mother died without him knowing that she did it, he would come running to her for comfort and they'd get back together. So that's the state's theory of the case, is that she...
Holy moly.
Her mother,
are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Wow.
Defense theory of the case is that the husband committed the murder. The motive being, there's evidence that the husband was having an affair with Mary Yoder's sister. And in fact, they were officially together in the months after Mary Yoder had passed
How
away.
Do we know this was even a murder and not an accidental over ingestion of this medication?
Yeah, that's one of the, I mean, you wouldn't likely take this yourself, especially being a doctor knowing that, but we had two trials in this case. And so this is sort of interesting because this is how my avenue came in investigating it. So we had a first trial. It was a hung jury, 10 jurors voting to acquit and two voting to convict.
Okay.
And these weren't just 10 jurors saying evidence doesn't prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. These were jurors saying, we think that she's innocent of
innocent.
The crime.
Mm.
Yeah. We have a second trial. Second trial, the jury again deadlocks. They tell the judge they're deadlocked. The judge gives them an Allen charge saying, you know, continue deliberating, see if you can reach a verdict. They still don't find Caitlin guilty of murder. They do find her guilty of the lesser included defense of manslaughter. And so that was then in 2021, Hillary's episode aired and Caitlin's sister reached out to me and said, can you review what happened between trial one and trial two? And so colchicine has sort of a period of, you feel the effect, you see the symptoms about 2 to 8 hours after death. And the state's theory again is Caitlin's the receptionist. She poisoned her boss's lunch at lunchtime.
So it lingers in the body 2 to 8 hours after death is what you're saying. After
well,
eight
no,
hours
no, no. It's, in other words, you ingest the colchicine. You don't show symptoms of poisoning until at least 2 hours after you ingest the colchicine.
Got it.
And then we see the effects of it 2 to 8 hours after death, the first symptoms appearing. Okay.
Well, wait, the symptoms appear after death?
In other words,
okay.
If she ingested at lunchtime,
yeah,
we would expect her to have, you know, red eyes, fatigue, et cetera.
Oh, in a couple of hours.
Within 2 to 8 hours after ingestion, and then ultimately it progresses and you die after that. But you first start to see the effects of it 2 to 8 hours after.
I get it. Okay.
And so looking at trial one, there was a patient of Dr. Yoder. And she says, I had an appointment with Dr. Yoder at 10:30 a.m. on the day this all happened. And I told this to an investigator before Caitlin Conley was arrested. At the time, Dr. Yoder had red eyes, like she was sick, coming down with a cold, ill, had a hay fever. She's usually very high energy. Her energy was low. She appeared fatigued. She appeared tired. These are all symptoms of colchicine poisoning. This is 10:30 a.m.
Yeah.
Hour and a half before lunchtime for Dr. Yoder, meaning almost certainly she would have been poisoned before she went to work. At trial two, Caitlin Conley has a new lawyer and he doesn't call this patient.
What?
I have a phone call with the attorney. He seems unaware that this witness existed. And so,
what? I'm sorry, I'm just losing my mind.
And so basically there were two claims for ineffective assistance of counsel.
Yeah.
One is
why
not call this witness at trial two? The other is they got a warrant to seize Caitlin's cell phone, not a warrant to search it. And so this was just, last Friday, as we record this, so like February 2nd or something like that, appellate court in New York finds it was ineffective assistance of counsel not to move to suppress what was found in the cell phone. There was no warrant to search it. Mm-hmm. And because they find that's dispositive, they don't even get to the issue of whether it was ineffective assistance not to call this witness at trial too.
Was there anything incriminating in the cell phone? Like, why was that even important?
Yeah, well, there is some evidence on the cell phone that she had done some searches regarding colchicine.
Oh, no.
Which, look.
That don't look good, Colin.
On the other hand, there's evidence that the husband had used colchicine in harvesting of marijuana plants. And so there were multiple people in this case
very
looking at colchicine for whatever reason in the case. And so, overall, in this case... Oh, and this is interesting, again, tying back to what we just discussed with Alfred, please. Just this Tuesday, a couple of days ago, so her conviction was thrown out. And while the DA is deciding whether to take it to a grand jury again, they said, we want to hold her in prison, in jail, while we decide whether to take this case to another grand jury. Obvious in my mind thinking being, if she's in jail, she's likely there to accept an Alford plea, which I'm guessing is coming in this case. And the judge said, no, she's released. If you indict her, okay, we can again have her in jail. But yeah, she this Tuesday on.
And so you helped work on the appeal, the post-conviction.
Yeah.
Appeal.
So yeah, it's they reached out to me. And so I worked with Caitlin's attorney sort of drafting this. It's a 440 motion in New York. In effect,
Amazing. That's fantastic. You've also been working on another case, but you're priming that for an undisclosed season, right? So maybe we're not going to talk about that.
Yeah, I have a case I'm working for undisclosed that we will have later this year. I have a few other cases. Did you have anything else on your end?
I can talk about a couple of things that I've been working on primarily. Well, okay. I'm not working on this case, but it is a rabbit hole that I cannot get myself out of, and I'm doing my best to work on it. Let's put it like that. Yeah. I guess in the months following the hiatus on Undisclosed, I began developing a new show called Robbie and Ellen Solve the Case with my co-host Ellen Marsh, who is an actor and comedian. And the idea there was that it was going to be like in one episode, we'd have guests on who like public people, you know, people with public profiles to talk about cases they're obsessed with. But our very first episode was about Scott Peterson. And this was well before Scott Peterson was represented by the Innocence Project. And we made the case, and, you know, because I did the investigative work on research, let's say that it's research. It wasn't investigative work on it. And I was like, oh gosh, I think we might have gotten this wrong. And, you know, I all these years really did believe that he was also guilty of killing his wife, Lacey Peterson. Anyhow, so much has come to light since his conviction that I really think that he was wrongfully convicted and is factually and actually innocent. So we kind of made the case on our premiere episode of Robbie and Ellen Solve the Case. His sister-in-law, we were in touch with his sister-in-law, and a few months later, the Innocence Project took it up. I mean, I'm not taking credit for it, but I feel like there's been kind of a big push for his exoneration and innocence and more awareness that he might be innocent, like in the last couple of years. And I'm glad to be part of that. And having said that, Scott and I have been in communication because I have offered to work on the case. I want to work on the case. Let's just leave that. So, but it's something that I'm constantly just kind of researching and working on independently, but I'm not officially working on the case. Mm-hmm. What I am officially working on is a case that came to me 2 years ago, and it came to me a couple of months. It came to me like in October, November, 2022. And it was just like a month or two before my father passed away. He was in hospice care at my home. So I couldn't immediately, obviously, I had a lot of things on my plate. And after my father passed away, I needed a few more months. And then I finally started looking at it. And this is a very, very, very high profile case in the world of counterterrorism and terrorism prosecutions. And this is the case of Dr. Afia Siddiqui. Now, most people have no idea who this person is, have never heard the name. But if you are part of the global Muslim community, you know who she is. And the reason you know who she is because during our war on terror, about, I guess it was like 2009, 10, Dr. Afia's name started appearing in news. And it was because the FBI and CIA and other, you know, agencies involved in war on terror said, this is the most dangerous woman in the world. They were calling her Lady Al-Qaeda. They said she's disappeared somewhere, but we believe she's selling blood diamonds in Kenya. It was like a manhunt, a massive international global manhunt. It appeared on the cover of Newsweek. It was all over the place. And she was a Pakistani national, but she got her PhD at Brandeis University. She spent much of her career in Boston and her life in America. She comes from a very highly educated family. The whole thing was bizarre, but this was an era at which if you are part of the Muslim community and the authorities are like, this woman's a terrorist, nobody wants to touch it. Nobody wants to touch it, go to bat for it. Like, we're like, no, we don't know her. That's what happened. Anyhow, she was 5 years after this manhunt launched, discovered wandering in Afghanistan, and she was arrested by Afghani police, and they said that she was on a mission to blow up the governor's mansion in, I think it was in Kabul or one of the cities, Ghazni. And as they were questioning her, this is the state's narrative, they asked U.S. military personnel to come in to help with the interrogation, and they say at the time that happened, one of the U.S. officers put down his weapon And she picked it up and started firing and yelled things straight out of a Steven Seagal movie, like "Death to America" and "Kill the Infidels," and started shooting. Except she shot nobody, and she herself was shot 4 times in the stomach. So she's brought to New York then with the bullet still in her stomach, and she's tried and she's charged with basically assault on a federal officer, like attempted murder of a federal officer. The only evidence against her is the testimony of a few people who were apparently present at that time. Forensic testing of the gun showed that it had actually never been fired. Other evidence that the state presented has since been debunked. And when I had heard about this case for years, because they're finally like, in the Muslim imagination, it was like, you know what, she was just kind of a martyr to the war on terror. But there were always efforts to like raise money for her, for her defense, this and that. But it just went nowhere. And it was a circus. Her trial was a circus. She had lawyer after lawyer, some appointed by the government, some paid for by the government of Pakistan. Her 2 children were with her when she had disappeared. And it turned out the whole time they were looking for her on this manhunt, she actually was being held in a U.S. prison in Bagram, Afghanistan. Her children were with her when she disappeared. Those children mysteriously reappeared years later, including one who was delivered to the family by the president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai. So the Afghani government's involved, the Pakistani military's involved. There are witnesses who say that this was a time at which we were, in fact, the U.S. military was paying bounties for people in Pakistan and Afghanistan. If you turn in a terrorist, will give you like $500, whatever, right? There are witnesses who say they saw the bounty exchange hands for her. It is a crazy, crazy case. And after spending 6 months looking at it, I really believe, as close as I humanly possibly can believe, that she's actually factually innocent of these charges. She has now served, I believe it's been like 14 years now, 12, 14, something like that. And she's held in a federal medical facility because she's kind of been tortured into psychosis. So this case is got so many layers. And up until really weeks ago, I guess, really a month ago, the legal team, and for a long time, she was not represented. When the family came to me, they had reached out to me and a lawyer who had done a lot of Guantanamo cases at the same time. He agreed to take on the case. I agreed to take on the case, and we've been working together. But his bid was really for clemency from President Biden before he left office. And a month ago, on his last day in office, President Biden denied that clemency. So I had been kind of waiting to see how that all panned out before I dug back into the case. And now that that's been denied, we're picking back up. I really think in this case, well, I'll say this, and there's nothing private about this because it's a very public campaign. Her attorney, Clive, has done a ton of media. Her sister's her biggest advocate. I have gone and visited the family multiple times in Pakistan, met with her grown children, who don't even remember what their mother looks like anymore. But what he's hoping to do now is a prisoner swap with a prisoner in Pakistan. But Pakistan doesn't want her back. And she's a very low value prisoner here, frankly, but she has an 86-year sentence. With a terrorism enhancement. And so that's the case. And I firmly believe the prisoner swap's not going to happen. I think this is going to be a straight post-conviction type of case. We just got to get her a new trial. And so that's where I'm at in that case. It's I know Adnan Syed's case was a big case, and we're getting to that. But this might be, if we have any success, maybe the biggest thing I do in my life, because it's such a big, big case. Oh. All
Yeah.
right.
Someone reached out to me a few years ago about filing a compassionate release motion for her, and it sort of
Really?
didn't go anywhere at the time. But yeah, that case wasn't on my radar,
That's
definitely.
amazing. I wonder who reached out to you. You know, it could have been, in fact, one of the family members, because her sister, when we finally did connect, said, "You know, we have tried to reach you in different ways over the years." I'm like, "Really? I have gotten zero communication." But again, it was one of those things where even if they had come, I was like, "Oh, it was a terrorism case." I mean, like, it's, but the truth is, the war on terror also produced lots of wrongful convictions. I got a list of them, and I've thought long and hard about maybe we start featuring a couple of them, here and there, in undisclosed. And but it's hairy. People, I don't know if people are ready yet to admit that we got a lot of shit wrong in those years following 9/11.
Right.
But let's talk now about what our season one relaunch is going to be when we're back this late spring.
Yeah, and so we are going back to where it all started, and we're going to do a look back and a look forward now in the Adnan Syed case, going through evidence we've never talked about before. My bombshell.
Oh God, Colin, I am.
Yes.
If I could get paid $5 for every time somebody asked me about your bombshell, I'd be so rich right now. I wouldn't do undisclosed anymore.
Yeah.
People have been waiting for years for your bombshell.
Right now, of course, the situation we're in now with Adnan is that we're in litigation hell, I guess you can say, with regard to his case. The motion to vacate throwing out his conviction was overturned based upon lack of notice to Haman Lee's family. And so now there's sort of two tracks going on, right? One is seeking resentencing under juvenile resentencing laws, and one is eventually refiling some version of the motion to vacate and having another hearing on that to dismiss the charges against him.
It is a very convoluted and confusing procedural history. Believe me, we are all, I mean, even all the lawyers watching this are like, what is happening in Maryland? I just haven't seen something like this happen before. I fully expected, the court to respect the victim's family's request, but also dismiss it, But event, let's just say the conclusion was that the Supreme Court of Maryland said, look, the victim's family requires more notice, do this hearing all over again with a new judge. And so that's what's kind of lingering because now we have a new district attorney, a new state's attorney in charge, which is Ivan Bates. It was Marilyn Mosby who had dropped the charges and, filed the motion to vacate. And so the question is, well, is this office gonna like withdraw the motion to vacate? Are they gonna come back and do and repeat kind of what Marilyn Mosby did? How do they feel about his innocence? Which shouldn't be a question given that Ivan Bates has publicly supported Adnan's innocence, been on the documentary, on the HBO documentary himself, but he's in a different position now, right? And so he might have and he might even feel like I maybe gotta recuse myself given my personal feelings about this. But anyhow, that the state's attorney's office has not made a decision on how to move forward or not move forward on the motion to vacate. But what happened quite recently was that and this is how kind of the whole motion to vacate thing started, was that Adnan's attorney, Eric Souter, who now runs the Innocence Clinic at University of Baltimore Law School, had actually approached the state's attorney's office to ask them how they would feel if we filed a petition under the JRA, the Juvenile Restoration Act, which would have given Adnan a reduced sentence if they had joined. And as they began their investigation, they're like, wait a minute, we think this might be an innocence case. And the whole thing really was. It wasn't something that we brought up. They brought it up and they did their own investigation and then they reached their conclusion. Anyhow, we never filed that petition because it never came to that. And we ended up doing the motion to vacate instead. Anyhow, Erica did file the motion, a motion under the JRA, asking for a reduced sentence for Adnan, addressing all the factors that are considered. And just about, I think, 2 weeks ago, the state's attorney's office said, we're joining the motion. We agree that. Adnan Syed was a juvenile and that he meets all these different requirements, and we believe he should have time served. So that's the second track. So we have that now, which is a big relief because for 2 years now, Adnan's been more than 2 years, he's been a free man. He's been working. The question of whether he is safe in society, I mean, that should all be put to rest. He has demonstrated he's been working for Georgetown University with their prison justice initiative. He is married. People don't. Know that very popularly, but it's now in the petition, so I can say that publicly. In fact, he didn't get married when he got out. He was married before his release. And she's wonderful, has been an incredible supporter. He has been taking care of his elderly parents and her elderly parents. And his father recently passed away, and he got to be there at the funeral. He was there for my father's funeral, and he's been living his life as a free man. And so the sword hanging over his head that he might have to go back to prison if the motion to vacate is not upheld. Was terrifying. And so the fact that the state has now joined this motion for resentencing basically is a big relief. It does not mean the judge will grant it, but it's a good sign, right? It's a good sign. In the interim, we still don't know how they're going to respond to the motion to vacate. And in the interim, Haman Lee's family once again has interjected themselves in the JRA proceedings or the pleadings and been like, we have something to say too, and they are objecting to like basically relief under this motion.
Right.
And Colin, I recently expressed on a live I did my frustration with the fact that, like, I mean, I don't know. Maybe there are other cases in which the family of the victim gets this much input into a case like this, but I feel like I've never seen it before. And also legally, you know, they want to like prosecute the case themselves, frankly. That's what it seems like over and over. They want to present evidence, you know, and they can't do that. So what are your thoughts about that whole thing, about their involvement?
Yeah, I actually have an article coming out. They reached out to me at the University of Baltimore Law Review to write a piece about the Supreme Court of Maryland's opinion allowing the victim impact testimony in this case. And it's interesting because Maryland is kind of ground zero for victim impact statements.
Yeah.
There's this Booth case that was initially decided by the Supreme Court of Maryland and overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. And the piece, as I'll address it, speaks to the fact that victim impact statements can be especially damaging even when they're given when a person has been found guilty. But my argument in the piece is to say when someone has been found innocent, or at least the victim of a Brady violation, and we're simply asking legal questions about what should follow, there's no place for victim impact statements. And it's dangerous precedent in my argument for Maryland to allow this. In this case, it could forestall not just Adnan's case, but plenty of other innocence cases around the country if other courts follow this precedent.
Yeah. And, you know, it's, I mean, Heyman Lee's brother did give a statement. You know, they halted the judge halted the proceedings at the time, the hearing, so that her brother could come and he could give his statement. He spoke for quite a while when she made her ruling a few years ago. And, but, you know, victim impact, I guess what you're saying is you're including like the fact that they want to actually present evidence as part of the victim impact statement, but they want to do it through an attorney, which is not even victim impact.
No, and that's part of my argument is this isn't even a traditional victim impact statement. A victim impact statement is, look, here is our loved one. Yeah. This is why they were a wonderful person, why their loss means so much to us and the community, et cetera. It is not coming in and saying, we think this was not a Brady violation because here's our interpretation of Supreme Court precedent. That's not a victim impact statement. That is a position paper. That's an argument, which is a legal matter, right, which is left to the parties to the case. And so, yeah, I mean, it's not even.
And victim impact statements are given after a jury reaches its verdict, generally before sentencing, right? Like to give the, you know, victim's family a chance to unburden their heart a little bit, to say what they want to say. And in those victim impact statements, even if they wanted to say that, you know what, I mean, look, those victim impact statements are happening if a person has been found guilty. They're not happening if a person's acquitted at the end of the trial, right? So, you know, the result is already there. I mean, like, even if they wanted to talk about more evidence during their victim impact statement, it does not have any kind of legal bearing on the actual case because the jury's reached its verdict. I think this is really dangerous precedent for any kind of innocence work across the country, or even just, you know, any kind of criminal proceeding at this point. It's like it's a hard, I mean, like, you know, you want to balance a victim's family's rights with due process, fairness for the defendant. And I don't know. Have you seen this ruling from the Maryland Supreme Court be used in any other cases across the country?
Not yet. No, that's my article. I write about it. It hasn't been done yet, but I'm fearful that in other innocence hearings, now attorneys for family members might try to do this. And again, not just come in and say, this is what our family member meant to us, they were a wonderful person, but actually to try to attack the legal proceedings. And it's interesting because the ABA just came out on Friday at their mid-year conference, and they said, we should make it so that legislatures adopt laws that clear paths procedurally for prosecutors seeking to undo wrongful convictions. And so they're kind of speaking directly to this issue of saying, look, if the prosecution is saying we secured wrongful conviction, we should be doing everything to remove roadblocks to them undoing that, as opposed to what Maryland is doing, which is erecting new roadblocks against
them. I mean, given that, you know, like I've always heard the maxim since law school that, you know, courts like finality, they don't want to like litigate forever. This just feels like it's creating so many more opportunities for things to be dragged out. And what do you think about have you read the the filing that the Haman Lee's family did in response to the JRA petition?
I haven't had the chance to read it yet now.
Oh, I mean, there's no case law cited. It's just we're not okay with this. And what they're asking, what they're requesting is that we don't want the judge to make any decision on this until and unless the state's attorney makes a decision on the motion to vacate. And I, again, fried brain, I'm trying to figure out what is strategically advantageous to them in asking for that. Do you have any ideas? I don't understand how that would help them in any way.
Yeah, I'm not. I need to read the filing to see, and I'm not sure at this
All
point.
right. Well, the state's attorney has requested for the court to set a hearing date for late February. I think they asked for the 25th, 26th. Of course, we'll all be there. We'll keep you updated, but we will be back not only, I mean, there's a lot of stuff, and there's a lot of stuff I want to talk about that never got aired during the investigation, during the making of the documentary. Other witnesses came forward, people had other things to say, and we're like, oh, you can't kind like, you know, it didn't work out.
Psychic. We have a psychic in the
We
case.
have psychics, we have gosh, we have a woman who came forward who worked with Don's mom at the time this happened, and she had stuff to say.
A lot of
There's a lot of interesting things that didn't quite make the HBO
Takara.
documentary. Or what's that?
Takara, people might know Takara from my blog. We have
Oh,
information on Takara, quote unquote.
yeah. So it'll be interesting. And you know what? I feel like because I'm firmly of the belief that this thing is just not going to end until and unless, you know, we have a second case in which like a determination made about who the actual killer is. And that's still a possibility because there is DNA evidence that was found from Haman Lee's shoes, which in fact led to the charges being dropped against Adnan that has never been sourced. It excludes Adnan. We don't know the source of it, but there is genetic genealogy, and my fingers are crossed that that Ivan Bates' office does something with it. But anyhow, I'm excited about starting back up with Adnan's case.
Yeah.
All
Two quick
right.
notes before we end, I wanted to say briefly. One is, and this has already been reported on CNN and The Atlantic, the case of CJ Rice, a 17-year-old. He was treated by Ted Tapper, the father of Jake Tapper. He was
Oh,
exonerated. Yeah, he was exonerated recently. That was a case I worked on, but really it was my student, Abigail Gowdy, who has worked on several of our cases. She found the critical argument in that case that led to CJ ultimately being exonerated. So shout out to Abigail. She's done great work, dark
Amazing.
and rose.
Congratulations. Yeah.
And then Michelle Healy, I think I've mentioned on other podcasts, is a shaken baby syndrome case, which I'm
Yes.
not going to say too much about because it's in an interesting place in the status. But if you've looked around the press, we'll probably discuss this in more detail later on the podcast. Shaken baby syndrome is basically being declared junk science and has led to any number of caretakers, especially women, being wrongfully convicted. And we're starting to see finally the courts catch up with the science and shaken baby syndrome being essentially junk science.
So here, you know, here's the thing. Over the last 10, 15 years, we've seen a lot of what we considered, thanks to the CSI effect, you know, actual science, actual forensic science to be debunked. But there's no uniform adoption across the country where courts are just not allowing it. I see it being admitted over and over in cases. In fact, by the way, for folks, just so you know how we're planning on doing this, we will have a couple of seasons a year where we cover and do in-depth investigations and do what we do with Undisclosed. And in the interim, Colin and I are going to be doing kind of a talk show type. We're going to be talking about like stuff that's in the news, updates, whatever we kind of feel like talking about in criminal justice and true crime. So speaking of tying that to what I'm about to say now, speaking of junk science, I don't know if you followed the trial of Richard Allen with the Delphi murder case and the ballistic evidence in that, which has been debunked and I by people in the field, but it was you know admitted it was and he was found guilty, and that is a very high profile case and one in which I am absolutely not convinced that he's guilty. In fact, I lean towards factual innocence, but this is a frustration that when it was brought up in court, you know, the judge was like, oh really, oh there people have objections to this evidence. That's the problem with this stuff, like it's frustrating.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Like one of the, if we were doing the podcast currently, you might have seen this in the news recently, Rabia, the case of Brenda Andrew, who is the only woman on death row in Oklahoma. She was convicted of the murder of her husband, and the prosecution, the argument, he displayed her thong underwear to the jury because she traveled with her new boyfriend with thongs after her husband died, and his argument to the jury was a grieving widow does not travel with a thong. And so I wrote this article in the Texas A&M Law Review asking
Holy
this
moly.
Court in the case.
Was this like in 1950? When did this happen?
I mean, 20-ish years ago.
Oh, my Lord.
I asked the Supreme Court to find a constitutional right to exclude evidence. And just a few weeks ago, the Supreme Court said there is a constitutional right to exclude evidence. And so the junk science we're talking about, I could see attorneys coming in now and saying, whether it is shaken baby syndrome, whether it's the Black Widow, we had the Pamela Gere case, the Brenda Andrew case. There's a mechanism now for defense attorneys to argue this violates the Due Process Clause.
The U.S. Supreme Court or the Texas Supreme Court?
The U.S. Supreme Court.
No way. Colin, you are a superhero. That's amazing. This
will be a useful mechanism. I think it's...
Heck yeah. That'll be incredible. That's wonderful. Thank you so much. All right, guys. Well, we are excited to be back, and we are going to get to work and come back with a brand new season. I think we're thinking mid-April, but, you know, we don't know exactly, but it'll be before the summer starts. Feel free to reach out to us. And how can folks find you online, Colin?
They can reach me at EvidenceProf on Blue Sky. I'm still on X for now. I might pivot over completely to a Blue Sky. My blog is EvidenceProf blog, and they can go to the University of South Carolina webpage to see my email address.
You can contact me through my website. It's robbyatchaudhry.com. There's a contact page there. My Twitter account was hacked about a year ago, and it's being held hostage, and I have not made the transition to Blue Sky yet, but I might find myself there soon. And also I'm on Instagram. My handle is at Rabia Squared with the number 2. So feel free to reach out. We'd love to hear from you, and we'll be back in your feed full time soon.